Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I gave a lecture at Boston University when I was at Boston College on the basis of this book I'd written called Shows About Nothing. And there's a nihilist group that put up protest posters next to the posters promoting my lecture. But in good nihilist form, they didn't show up for the lecture. Okay, I want to try. I'm on the clock here, so 15 minutes. I want to try to talk about three things and then take some questions. Really honored to be part of this. I love everything the Thomistic Institute does. If we have if we could bottle this and scale it, which you all are doing apparently, it's pretty clear that you're scaling it, this could be a cure for what ails us socially. And the data is not heartening on friendship in our culture. Surveys from, say, the 1970s and 80s up to today, people had 3.4, 3.5. I'm not sure what the 0.4 or 0.5 friendship does for you, but maybe somebody you can help to get you to when you need to move or something. So 3.5 friends down to like 1.7. So cut in half. Civic friendship is in even worse shape, not surprisingly. Surveys, I remember John Haidt, who works on these, has a really good book just out called The Anxious Generation. That's you. You're the anxious generation. Hopefully you're not, but your generation is. He posted something during the Kavanaugh hearings, which seems like it was 30 years ago now, where he said, if you want to know how we got where we are, and he posted a survey asking Americans the question, do you hate members of the other political party? That 70s, 80s, 90s, it's about 15%. It rises at about 2010 up to about 45%, which is an astonishingly high percentage of people who are engaging in not civic friendship, but deep civic animosity. More than 50% of people recently surveyed said, no one knows me deeply. Loneliness, lack of belonging. I think this feeds into a kind of vicarious search for belonging and community on social media, which also feeds into a need for identity politics as a kind of belonging and partisan politics as a kind of belonging. Loneliness, when there was an article last month, I think, called Why Americans Quit Hanging Out. And there's a close connection between loneliness and this. I hate to use this as a verb. I hate to use this word at all. Catastrophizing. The tendency to see any difficulty in exponentially more difficult and apocalyptic terms. We're inarticulate about lots of things. We don't have a good vocabulary for talking about good and evil. We don't have a good vocabulary anymore for talking about death or birth. We don't have a really good vocabulary for talking about friendship. It's really striking if you go back to Aristotle, the first sustained discussion of friendship in the Ethics. 10 books in the Ethics, 2 of them are devoted to friendship. I defy you to find an ethics textbook written in the last 2 centuries that says much at all about friendship. It's in part because Aristotle has a different model of ethics. The ethical is coextensive with human life. It's not a matter of isolated moral dilemmas. It's about leading a flourishing human life. Friendship is crucial to Aristotle for lots of reasons. One of them is that Aristotle thinks if we're going to pursue happiness, we're going to have to find, identify activities that are worth pursuing for their own sake, right? If every activity is a means to something else, if all our activities are instrumentalized, which much of our lives are, and to some significant extent your lives are, right? You take certain classes so you can prepare for a career or so that you can get a certain GPA, so that you can prepare for the MCAT or the LSAT or whatever it might be. Tocqueville has a very interesting reflection on Americans where he says that Americans in their restless pursuit of happiness think they're going to find it right around the next corner. they get there and they're disappointed. But instead of learning the lesson that that way of pursuing happiness is futile, they run to the next corner thinking it's going to be there. And then very depressingly, he says, at last they die. This is a failure to discover, to discern, and pursue activities that are worth pursuing for their own sake. Friendship is perhaps it's certainly among the most immediately obvious of the activities that is worth pursuing for its own sake. If you have a roommate who says, I don't understand why you spend so much time hanging out with your friends, and you say, what would you say, right? It's enjoyable, right? These are not merely friendships of pleasure or utility, but friends. Someone who persists in asking that question is likely never to have a friend. And we would say there's something deficient in their appreciation of the human good, because it's not the payoff of friendship that matters. It's simply being with your friends. Quality of friendship matters. That's a tough thing, right? Because you can't really go shopping for friends. You could, and there are probably friendship apps. It's like there are dating apps. But friendship is this odd mixture of chance and choice, right? Think about the friends you have. Many of them are people you met just by happening to be in a certain class or part of a theater group in high school or on a sports team or part of the Thomistic Institute, right? You get to the Thomistic Institute, it's more likely that there's going to be some deep overlap in terms of commitments and convictions. But many of the friends we have, as Lewis says, many friendships begin with the insight, what, you too? Right? You're sitting amongst a group and you're the only two people who have a certain sense of humor or who are laughing at all the other people in the room in a certain way. There is an element of chance, but it's also about shared activities. And the key question is what sort of activities, right? Lewis says romantic relationships are face-to-face, friends are side-by-side. I think that's basically right. I don't think that Lewis is entirely right about that. So from Aristotle, we learn that friendship is an actualization of us, where we desire to be with others for the sake of being with them, where we're living together with folks for a long haul. These are not superficial relationships. Aristotle thinks that we're fortunate if we have a few really good friends. So it's over the long haul of life. And Aristotle, here I want to shift to Aquinas for an insight that I think Aristotle comes close to articulating. So Aristotle certainly thinks that we ought to, as Paul says, and he almost uses this language, rejoice with our friends and grieve with our friends. He also asks whether it's better to love than to be loved. And he says it's better to love. Loving indicates a greater actualization of the soul, which might seem to you odd as a justification for saying that it's better to love than to be loved. But he also uses, this is a really astonishing example in Aristotle, he uses the example of mothers who might not actually be raising their own children, but are loving them when they get nothing in return and happy to see them flourish, which is odd in lots of ways. It's odd that he picks mothers, first of all, and it's also odd that this is not an equal or reciprocal relationship, which are characteristics of friendship for Aristotle. I think he comes close there to something like sacrificial love in activity. So it's not just about me being active. It's actually about loving the other person for his or her own sake. Let me shift quickly. These are quick transitions here. When Aquinas talks about charity, he says there are three effects of charity: peace, joy, and mercy. If I ask you which one of these doesn't belong, and you were to think about it a little bit, mercy is an odd thing in that list. Peace and joy are about resting and delighting in the divine good and in sharing that with others. Mercy is about Mercy is a kind of sorrow, right? Mercy and envy are kinds of sorrow. Envy is sorrow over another's good fortune. Mercy is sorrow over another's affliction. So at the heart of charity for Thomas is a willingness to make other people's afflictions my own. Mercy is being moved in the heart at the suffering and affliction of another, and if I can do anything about it, and it's prudent, being willing to do something about it. So I want to suggest at the heart of, and this is more than I'm learning this summer from my Baylor students I'm with about for the first time about trauma bonding and trauma dumping. And we had a long conversation about that, how that's not exactly what Aquinas is talking about. But there is at the heart of Christian friendship, and I think this captures an insight that Aristotle comes close to that we experience, that but he doesn't quite get it, that the notion that through deep shared suffering, through sorrow, we are, after all, a people who have been saved by a man of sorrows, and we honor and adore Our Lady of Sorrows. We are people who think that sorrow is at the heart of our life in this world, and that how we cultivate and how we respond to sorrow is crucial for the state of our souls, both here and in eternity. Aquinas says about sorrow, when he's got this wonderful list of the five things that assuage or ease sorrow, sleep and baths, he recommends. Those are good things. He'd probably say, I don't know if he'd say exercise or not. I don't think Aquinas was a jogger. But one of the things he mentions is friendship. And friendship alleviates suffering in two ways. One is that sorrow is actually a weight. You can use the term depression to describe what Aquinas is talking about. Aggravare is the verb. That sorrow aggravates the soul, which means irritates but also weighs down. And insofar as our friends share in our suffering, they would seem to ease that burden. The second reason is really interesting. Insofar as our friends are present, we know we're loved, which is deeply pleasant to us and a counter to sorrow. So the reflection on friendship here is really rich in both Aristotle and Aquinas. And I think by studying Aristotle closely, we can see how far, and this is, I take Aquinas' approach to pagan philosophy, particularly Aristotle, to see how far you can go. We want to commend Aristotle for his deep and lasting insights about friendship. But I think also at crucial points in his discussion of friendship, just as in his discussion of the divine nature and so forth, happiness, you can see where Aristotle comes to the cusp of something, and then he doesn't quite know what to say. And that's where Aquinas, I think, wants to say, well, the gospel speaks to that question and into that silence. And that is perhaps, for me, in my thinking about friendship, one of the ways in which you can see faith and reason working together to draw out and explain to us the experiences we have of friendship and to help us become better friends and acknowledge the gifts of the friends that we have. Thank you.
I'm grateful to the Thomistic Institute for the invitation to speak this morning, and I'm certainly honored to share stage with Professor Hibbs. I'm happy to say that my remarks this morning complement his on nearly every point. Among the various complaints that critics of modernity make, their lament over the reductive tendencies of modern thought remains hard to dispute. In the modern view, reality has indeed shrunk in appearance. It has not expanded. As over recent centuries, philosophical schools and scientific tools, for all of their increased precision, have closed their focus around more numerous but smaller aspects of the real. The reduction of the scope of reason from the intelligible to the sensible, from the speculative to the practical, from the demonstrable to the measurable, mark our age's common thinking and common speaking. We know more things, but about fewer kinds of things compared to our ancient and medieval forebears. From an Aristotelian point of view, our practical command of material and efficient causes has increased, while our speculative command of formal and final causes has decreased. And not without consequence for the believer and the unbeliever alike. In his Regensburg address, now almost 20 years old, the late Pope Benedict called the Western Academy's attention to modernity's predicament. The writings of St. Thomas Aquinas and his moral works in particular witness to a time in human intellectual history when man's glimpse of reality was wider than it is today. Because of the vast range of what he understood man could know and love by nature and by grace, and thereby what man could do by nature and by grace, St. Thomas articulated and recorded perhaps the widest glimpse of reality ever communicated. Garrigou-Lagrange seemed to reach this conclusion, at least. He saw no fault in entitling his synthesis of Thomistic thought simply reality. For St. Thomas and his students, the light of reason, enhanced by the light of faith, swims in an intelligent ocean of created and even uncreated being. All that is falls within the human intellect's grasp. All that is can be known and loved by man. As intelligent creatures, men and women are made to comprehend and live within the whole of being. They are made to master the material world, to build virtuous communities, and even by knowledge and by love, by grace, to possess divine persons. For the next few minutes, I want to highlight an aspect of St. Thomas's anthropology that for too long has gone underappreciated, even by contemporary Thomists. It is an insight into the social and political nature of the human creature. Why is man social? Why is man political? Why does man make friends? Why does he marry and have families? Why do friends and families build cities? Why is justice a perfective virtue of the human creature? In attempting to identify the principle of human sociability, some contemporary theologians point immediately to the communio of God as the source. For their part, some contemporary philosophers point to the natural generosity of the human spirit. Neither these theologians nor these philosophers are wholly wrong. They remind us of important truths. After all, the Trinity is the source of every created reality, and accordingly, all things, including the human soul, reflects the Trinitarian origin of their being and activity. But each of these approaches possesses a hidden risk if pursued too quickly and unreflectively. For all of their piety and personalism, these approaches can foster an angelism in anthropology, which encourages an individualism in morality that can reduce friendliness to instinctive self-expression and can instrumentalize sociability as a mere means to need fulfillment. In this world where individuals relate because of whom each is, instead of because of what is, there can be no real friends, nor can there be real societies, at least according to how the ancients and medievals understood these human realities to be. They remain instead, as Charles de Connick warned, confederacies of little tyrants. While recognizing both the Trinitarian origin of all things and the dynamism of the human spirit, St. Thomas locates the proximate principle of human sociability in neither. not within the human soul, but outside of it. And not within the Trinity, but in the created cosmic whole. According to St. Thomas, man finds himself living within a created whole and moving on a metaphysical and moral plane that makes him friendly and social. In other words, God has so wisely and lovingly structured creation that even before any act of his intelligence or exercise of his choice, man finds himself in a world of intelligently and hierarchically ordered commensurable goods. It belongs not to him only, but to all others. The need for these goods, the discovery of these goods, and the pursuit of these goods puts man necessarily in relation to others. And so far as some of these same goods are needed, discovered, and pursued by others. For St. Thomas, the providential existence of the common good of the family and of the common good of the city provides the proximate principle of all human communication, sociability, and friendship. These two common goods provide a defining finality for all human activity, within which human persons relate to each other as persons, with all of their potential and creativity. Even before the first movements of his intellect and will, man finds himself within, as St. Thomas calls it, the communicatio of the family and the communicatio of the city, and by extension, the communicatio of the cosmos and the communicatio of the church. All of these communicationes make all human communications, from the teasing of siblings to the affections of spouses, from the commands of kings to the prayers of saints, possible and intelligible. So strong is St. Thomas's sense of the objective, realist, metaphysical, and cosmic grounding of human sociability and friendliness, he concludes, to the surprise and even shock of modern sensibilities, a man does not love his family members. A man does not love his family because of his family members. He loves his family members because of his family. Likewise, a man does not love his city because of his fellow citizens. He loves his fellow citizens because of his city. Confirmation of St. Thomas's objective and realist conception of human sociability and friendliness can be found in his description of the virtue of justice. When he repeats the classical definition of justice as rendering the other his due, St. Thomas asks, who specifically is the other to whom the just due is rendered? He concludes that it is not the family member or the friend, for to them we give more than is due, but to the stranger, the one whom I do not know or know well, is the proper object of my just action. Why? Because St. Thomas concludes objectively, his good is my good. Or more precisely, because his common good is my common good. There exists between us, before ever any debt is incurred between us, a communicatio within our shared political community, or a communicatio between our political communities, that makes the fulfilling of the stranger's just claim a perfective action for me. I acknowledge, I love, I participate in the common good when I act justly to all others within the communicatio of that same good, especially those whom I may not know or for whom I may have no affection. There's much more to be said, much more to be rediscovered about St. Thomas's understanding of man's social and political nature, but for our purposes this morning, you've said enough. Why be a Thomist? Because we want to have real friends. We want to build real communities. St. Thomas and the entire Thomist tradition reminds us that reality, the whole of reality, provides for us to have and build both. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.